Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
In the first chapter of his treatise on politics, Aristotle traces a connection between our nature as rational creatures and our nature as political creatures. The crucial link is in the phenomenon of language. Speech, he says, indicates what is useful or harmful, and so also what is just or unjust. For strictly speaking, it belongs to human beings alone, in contrast with other animals, to perceive good and evil, just and unjust, and the like. And communicating these perceptions produces households and political communities. Aquinas, commenting on this passage, expands on the role of language in building community. Human speech, he says, signifies useful and harmful things, and so just and unjust things, since justice and injustice consist of persons being treated justly or unjustly regarding useful and harmful things. And so, speech is proper to human beings, since it is proper to them, in contrast with other animals, to have knowledge of good and evil, just and unjust, and the like, which speech can signify. Nature gives speech to human beings, and speech is directed to human beings communicating with one another regarding the useful and the harmful, the just and the unjust, and the like. Therefore, this is still Aquinas, since nature does nothing in vain, human beings by nature communicate with one another about these things. But communication about these things produces the household and the political community. Therefore, he concludes, human beings are, by nature, domestic and political animals. For both Aristotle and Aquinas, meaningful speech not only expresses common ideas about justice, it is the means by which we form those common ideas and make them practically effective in common life. We might think it is obvious that having a language in common is the result of political community. But Aristotle and Aquinas are emphasizing that having a language in common is what helps form political community, and that the community can form new members only by initiating them into the community's common conceptions of what is just and unjust, thus orienting them to participate in and contribute to achieving the common good. So we should note that this is not a relativistic observation. Today, when people notice that ideas and language are habituated or socially conditioned or socially constructed, and that different communities form differently based on different conceptions of justice and injustice, many people draw the conclusion that therefore none of the conceptions are really true, that justice and injustice are culturally contingent and subjective, and that we should no longer argue about and seek to understand the real nature of justice and injustice. Aristotle and Thomas, observing the phenomenon of social conditioning and the interdependence of conceptions of justice and the character of community, drew the opposite conclusion. The contingency of language and the fact of social conditioning means that we have all the more duty to reflect on and seek to responsibly embrace, refine, or revise ours and other cultures' conceptions of justice and injustice so that we can strengthen our communities and fulfill our obligation as rational creatures trying to live well with others. Now, sometimes we don't notice different conceptions of justice only between communities, but within communities. And as a result, we can sense, existentially and somewhat paradoxically, that we don't actually seem to constitute a form of community with others, insofar as we don't seem to have a shared language to communicate our understandings of justice and injustice. What we seem to share in such cases is only an experience of, let's call it, pluralism, which functionally means that all we share with others is disagreement and confusion about the nature of justice and the responsibilities we have towards each other in community, and even about the sense in which we are a community at all. This problem was often noted by the great philosopher who died earlier this month, Alistair MacIntyre. MacIntyre gave attention to ways that certain kinds of social structures could be systematically corrupt. And one of the signs of a corrupt social structure is not so much that it treats people as moral agents and directs them towards evil common purposes, but that it hides from people the ability to conceive of themselves as moral agents responsible to each other in common purpose in the first place. I take this to be a corollary of Aristotle's observation about language as community building. Conceptual fragmentation and linguistic confusion are thus contrary to the nature of authentic social life, preventing us from understanding and knowing things about ourselves that we need to know, preventing us from experiencing ourselves as members of communities, as political animals, in Aristotle's sense. Because being in this situation involves not being fully aware that one is in this situation, not being fully aware that one's situation is making it difficult for certain things to rise to one's awareness, it takes special effort to inquire into what one should but does not know. McIntyre thus once said that it has become, in the modern world, an indispensable moral maxim always to ask about your social and cultural order what it needs you and others not to know. All of this is a long windup to my thesis that one of the things our culture hides from us that it wants us not to know is the ability to make judgments about the naturalness of certain social forms. That what we actually need to know, but circumstances often keep us from knowing, is that there are natural societies, that some forms of social association have proper natures, that some forms of social organization are more natural than others, and that the fulfillment of our nature as social beings is inseparable from the fulfillment of the natures of certain kinds of social forms. Eventually, I will illustrate this by pointing out how crucial the idea of nature and the natural is to understanding Catholic social teaching, which I consider a development and application of Thomistic thought after the initiative of Pope Leo XIII. But first, I want to review some of the phenomena that lead us to ask about whether or what kinds of societies are natural in the first place, and the reason that we may already feel a need to talk about natural societies, as well as the reasons we find it challenging in current environment to do so. Then I will suggest some reasons why at least certain kinds of social bodies can be seen as natural, specifically in the Aristotelian sense, not only extrinsically because they come from something natural or are ordered towards something natural, but because they have an intrinsic and proper principle of motion. This will lead to a discussion of social agency, collective responsibility, or in legal terms, corporate personality. I will show how this idea survives in many common sense assumptions we still make, as well as in important legal and theological commitments. This capacity of moral agents to act as parts, members, or organs of larger social bodies or organisms that themselves have moral agency, indeed in and through which individual moral agency naturally expresses itself, will lead me in the last main part of the talk to reflect on the crucial role of nature in two key concepts of Catholic social teaching, specifically the common good and the principle of subsidiarity. So I've charted the path. The first step will be to clarify what it means to ask the question of my title, are societies natural, and rule out some possible confusions about what we might mean by societies and the natural. If you happen to come across the phrase natural societies in various historic authors, it's in Richard Hooker, for instance, there is a high chance that the contrast is with supernatural society, that is the church or the communion of saints. That is not the sense in which I am inquiring into natural societies. Rather, in the sense I am interested, supernatural societies are not an alternative to, but a subset of what I am talking about as natural societies. The sense of natural that I am interested in is contrasted with artificial, confected, something that has a unity imposed on it from without rather than its own intrinsic principle of order, organization, and action. So we are also asking not simply whether society or societies exist by nature, but also whether they have natures, whether there is a sense in which a society has its own intrinsic principle of unity and motion, or whether it only seems to have those things because it has received them per accidens as given to them by an external artificer. Society, the singular, also needs some clarification. I'm not using it in the broadest sense as the sum total of sociological phenomena, this society versus that society. I mean it as a specific association of individuals sharing a purpose, having some coordination, and a means for acting as a body and not merely as a collection of individuals. It is true that a large-scale society, such as a state, may be made up of many individual societies, such as cities, schools, families, guilds, professional associations, commercial corporations, etc. But if a state is a society, it is not because it is a collection of littler societies, but because it can itself be conceived of as a social whole, a society in its own right on a different, higher, or larger scale than the societies that may be found within it. So I'm asking, are these social wholes artificial or natural? Do social associations, at least some of them, have natures, not merely an essence in the sense of an intelligible definition that can be articulated, as of course artificial things can have, but an actual principle of unity and action that belongs to it per se? The history of political philosophy shows that there seems to be a clear choice between conceiving of political organizations as natural versus as artificial. Whether these are actual metaphysical alternatives or merely heuristics for political theorists is kind of beside the point. There's a clear choice in the history of political thought between two sorts of metaphors for understanding social unities, either emphasizing them as organic or as mechanistic. Either they emerge and develop as part of a natural order, as in the familial political origin stories told by Plato and Aristotle, or they are contrived by some imposition of contingent human will, as in the social contract theories of modern political philosophers, and also of Plato's character Thrasymachus. Note that even if political theorists had not done the work of articulating these alternative accounts of the origin of political order, historians and social observers would no doubt have documented the subjective shift felt by members of developing social orders, the gradual waning of the experience of organic social life, giving way to something more engineered, the model of the family replaced with the model of the legalistic bureaucracy, the move, as Henry Maine put it, from status to contract, the transition from humane Gemeinschaft to impersonal Gesellschaft. The ideal alternatives are useful markers, but the lived experience of human beings is often a functional confusion and conflation of these models. I recently heard a speaker who is being honored for her contributions to the common good invoke a definition of the common good which was thoroughly liberal and contractarian. It talked about the fair and equitable distribution of resources. It was not about a common good or purpose shared by members of a community, but about division of goods among independent individuals who were, if you thought about it, apparently deprived of a chance to think of themselves as members of a community. It was the thin individualist notion of common good as resource allocation, the kind of vision imagined from behind Rawls' veil of ignorance. What was fascinating was that the speaker, seemingly unaware of how deficient the definition of common good was, especially in a Catholic context, proceeded to describe herself in terms of membership and genuine community. She described concrete social roles, a narrative of life, a sense of individual purpose that was ordered towards a shared purpose of community. So grasping for formal theory, the speaker could only find explicit vocabulary that pointed towards social contract theory. But in her life and in her own natural voice, she was intuitively and thoroughly Aristotelian. The tension in the speaker between liberalism and Aristotelianism is sometimes evident even within the Catholic tradition, refracted into a spiritual dimension. Whether because of an emphasis on personal piety or as an artifact of Cold War concerns about collective totalitarianisms and ideologies, Catholic thinkers can be very wary of the communitarian social impulse I'm associating with Aristotle and classical philosophy. Take the last and I think best encyclical of Pope Francis, published last fall, Dilexit Nos. It focused on the importance of a personal relationship with Christ. On first glance, it was very unlike many of Francis's other encyclicals, which deal overtly with social issues. Its main focus was, I would call, a phenomenology of spirituality, emphasizing what it means for our hearts to be transformed by Jesus' love for us. So not surprisingly, on the one hand, the encyclical captures a common modern Christian wariness about focusing on social structures. At one point, Francis warns against being, quote, excessively caught up in external activities, structural reforms that have little to do with the gospel, obsessive reorganization plans, worldly projects, secular ways of thinking, and mandatory programs, all of which deprive us of the personal experience of friendship with Christ. On the other hand, almost 100 paragraphs later, Francis specifically emphasizes the need for healthy social forms. He quotes John Paul II, who said that a society is alienated if its forms of social organization, production, and consumption make it more difficult to offer the gift of self and establish solidarity between people. And so Francis exhorts followers of Christ to expose and resist these alienated social structures and to support efforts within society to restore and consolidate the common good. So even while inviting us to deeper personal relationship with Jesus, Francis calls attention to the threat of alienated social structures as contrasted with healthy social structures ordered to the common good. In the terms of Catholic social teaching, Francis is clearly looking beyond threats to distributive justice, how goods are shared in a community, and commutative justice, how people treat each other in a community, to legal or general justice, or we could call it social justice, how people share in advancing and enjoying the good of the community. Obvious threats to the common good include acts of fraud, treason, and factionalism, acts that prevent people from experiencing themselves as members of a shared community. But it was a long-standing theme of Francis's papacy, and also of his immediate predecessors, that other threats to shared community include bad ideas, ways of seeing the world that prevent people from conceiving of themselves as capable of authentic community, including ideologies, corrupt philosophy, and especially the technocratic mentality that frames human society in terms of artificial mechanisms to be manipulated instead of as organic associations of shared relationships. I've been taking for granted the common contrast between the organic and the mechanistic, the natural and the artificial, but let us consider a more theoretical account of what it is for something to be natural. And here I'm indebted to Chris Frey for covering territory that I can now do very quickly, but he went through a lot of this very well yesterday. What kinds of things are of nature or have a nature? The paradigmatic cases are biological organisms, things with a soul. But inanimate things, such as physical elements, also count as natural. And there are, as Professor Frey described, mixed cases where artifice is used to direct natural processes, as in breeding dogs, cultivating olives, or baking bread. So something can be a natural body and still be, in a sense, an artifact or informed by human art. Nor does nature have to correlate to substances. There are natural accidental unities. For example, the sexual difference of male and female, that's natural, and they reflect different natures, not substantial natures, but real accidental natures. We also can see that in these cases, there are degrees of naturalness that say, and here I'll use my own example of corrupt dogs, a retriever that can help the duck hunter might be more natural than, say, a bulldog bred not for any useful activity, but for conformity to some arbitrary standard of appearance. The bulldog has hips too narrow for natural birth and a snout too short for proper breathing. It might still win prizes in the dog show, but it is not healthy by any natural standard. I want to say also that parts of natural things can be natural, so that the organs of an organism are natural, as parts of a substance and not as substances themselves, and indeed here the organic parts of a substance can be more or less natural. For instance, in a life-saving transplant for a human being, a pig heart is, I suppose, more natural than a mechanical heart, but obviously less natural than another human heart, which is in turn less natural than the organism's own original heart. It was in the context of mixed cases that Professor Frey, you may remember, considered the political community, the city, and classed it as a case of art perfecting nature. So there is something natural. Human beings in association, people assembled seeking their ends together, but the political art shapes and directs that. There seems to be an ambiguity here, however, and so yesterday I had a question, which I will ask again. In the case of the city, is the nature perfected by art, the nature of individual humans, so that the art is what works on those individual humans and transforms them into a political whole? Or is the nature perfected by the art already a city, or at least a proto-city, a natural social whole over and above individual human natures, which is perfected but not confected by the political craft of directing the city and elevating it, say, by putting it under a particular form of constitution? I think it is clear that for Aristotle and Aquinas, the city is not confected but perfected by the political art, that the city is natural not only in the sense of being made up of people who have natures, but that the city itself is natural and has a nature. Aquinas thinks one of the first things Aristotle shows in the Politics is that villages are natural because they are an outgrowth of associations of families, which are also natural. Professor Frey actually put this key passage on PowerPoint yesterday, but I'm going to read it. When several villages are united in a single complete community, large enough to be nearly or quite self-sufficing, the state, the city, comes into existence, originating in the bare needs of life and continuing in existence for the sake of a good life. And therefore, if the earlier forms of society, that is the family and the village, are natural, so is the state, for it is the end of them, and the nature of a thing is its end. For what each thing is when fully developed, we call its nature, whether we are speaking of a man, a horse, or a family. Besides, the final cause and end of a thing is the best, and to be self-sufficing is the end and the best. Hence, it is evident that the state is a creation of nature, and that man is by nature a political animal, and he who by nature and not by mere accident is without a state is either a bad man or above humanity. In a subsequent passage, Aristotle drives the point home by treating the state as an organic whole and individuals as members, that is, parts or organs, dependent on the whole. Further, he says, the state is by nature clearly prior to the family and to the individual, since the whole is of necessity prior to the part. For example, if the whole body be destroyed, there will be no foot or hand except in an equivocal sense, as we might speak of a stone hand. For when destroyed, the hand will be no better than that. But things are defined by their working and power, and we ought not to say that they are the same when they no longer have their proper quality, but only that they have the same name. The proof that the state is a creation of nature, he continues, and prior to the individual, is that the individual, when isolated, is not self-sufficing, and therefore he is like a part in relation to the whole. But he who is unable to live in society or who has no need because he is sufficient for himself must be either a beast or a god. He is no part of a state. All of this seems to warrant the conclusion that for Aristotle and for Aquinas commenting on him, political communities are indeed natural. They have a unity and a principle of action, and part of their activity is maintaining themselves in being. Indeed, if we understand that in a political community, an authority acts not for himself, but on behalf of the whole, that the whole acts in and through the action of the authority, then I think we can say that a political community is natural in precisely the sense that Aristotle defines in the Physics. It has a principle or cause of change and of remaining the same, in that to which it belongs primarily, in virtue of itself, and not accidentally. Let us take the most natural society, the family. A legal system may recognize, say, a married couple and help to formalize and operationalize its status, but the reality of marriage exists prior to and independently of law, and the married partners can and do act as one, a political unit. The family can own property. One member of a family can act on behalf of the family as a whole, say, in hiring a contractor to do work on the family home. Of course, as codified in human positive law, the particular character and contractual rights may vary from one political state to the next. The marriage as formalized in law by a contract may be what we call a legal fiction, where fiction there doesn't mean that it is false, but that it is an artificial creation contrived by human convention. But that legal fiction, the codification of the marriage in positive law, is an attempt to recognize a reality that exists prior to and without laws. The corporate personality of the married couple as a recognizable social whole, with moral standing, with agency, with responsibility to its members and to the community. Modern law is full of recognition of corporate agency or corporate personality, some mapping onto more natural forms of social bodies than others. Profit and nonprofit business corporations can outlive the members that formed them and can be held responsible for crimes even if the individuals whose decisions or negligence caused the crimes are no longer part of the corporation. Cities can be held accountable for failing their citizens even if the relevant agents of city government are no longer around to be personally brought to justice. In many cases, the whole purpose of corporate personhood for cities or for business enterprises is to protect, literally to limit the liability of the individual people who act as their agents. It is typical to think that the responsibility of a social agency can always be reduced to the responsibility of particular individuals. But our moral judgments about social bodies, or judgments about guilt, responsibility, praise, or blame, are often not transferred to them or projected upon them from individuals, but can have their own distinctive manifestation in social wholes. The social wholes have agency and can be held responsible for action themselves, per se. The authoritative agent acting on behalf of the corporation does not act in himself, but as a member of an authority for the corporation. To be an integral member of a social whole is to be such that the member's activity belongs to the whole, and the nature of the whole determines the capacity of the member to act. We can judge a community as having distinctive virtues and vices, and we praise those communities that are, say, hospitable, fair, and courageous, while criticizing those that are cruel, corrupt, or cowardly. The argument of Socrates in Plato's Republic even suggests that it is easier to discern the nature of virtue and vice at the scale of political community. We start inquiry into the nature of the four cardinal virtues in the city at the large and macroscopic scale before ever trying to discern them in individual souls. So there is precedence in law, in common sense, and in classical philosophy for corporate responsibility. There is certainly precedence in Christian faith. How else to explain that God is just in visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation? The very notion of original sin is the most comprehensive and extreme case of holding a social whole responsible for the actions of an individual representative. Aquinas articulates this distinctively Christian idea in terms that we can now recognize as having to do with the naturalness of society as treated in Aristotle's Politics. In the De Malo, he explains original sin as physically transmitted to the whole human race, beginning with reflection on the sense in which the community is a moral agent. Here's St. Thomas. We can consider particular human beings in two ways. In one way, as individual persons. In the second way, as members of a community. And acts can belong to human beings in both ways. For example, acts that human beings do by their own choice and by their very selves belong to them as individual persons. And acts that are not done by their own choice or by their very selves, but by the whole community, or by the majority of the community, or by the ruler of the community, belong to human beings as members of the community. Just so, we say that the political community does what the ruler of the community does, as the philosopher says, for we reckon such a community as if one human being, so that different human beings with different functions are united as if different members of the same natural body, as the apostle points out in 1 Corinthians regarding members of the church. Aquinas continues to explain that God had bestowed at creation a supernatural gift, namely original justice, on the first human being. That first human being, when he, by his free choice, sinned, lost the gift in the same habitual condition in which he received it, namely for himself and all his descendants. Therefore, the privation of this gift extends to all his descendants. And so the privation is transmitted to them in the way in which human nature is transmitted. Obviously, from a certain perspective, it seems unfair for this sin to be transmitted by biological generation to the children. As Aquinas acknowledges, if we should consider this privation so transmitted by physical descent to a particular human being, insofar as the human being is an individual person, then such privation cannot have the nature of moral fault, for which voluntariness is a prerequisite. In other words, it wouldn't be fair for you to all be subject to some punishment for something that great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandpa Adam did, right? But Aquinas explains, we are not only biologically related to Adam, but politically related to him, part of his community, so that, he says, if we should consider a particular begotten human being as a member of the whole human nature propagated by our first parent, as if all human beings were one human being, then the privation of original justice has the nature of moral fault because of its voluntary source, that is, the actual sin of our first parent. It is, he explains, similar to the way in which, through the lustful eye or the murderous hand, the whole person is at fault for the crimes of a part. The whole human race is at fault for the crime of the first member of the community. In this account of social agency or corporate responsibility, we have seen that Aquinas drew on Aristotle's Politics and its account of the naturalness of social bodies. But it also seems that he had in mind, or could have had in mind, Aristotle's Physics and its account of nature as a principle or cause of change and of remaining the same in that to which it belongs primarily in virtue of itself and not accidentally. The members of a community belong to it, and the member or members who act on behalf of the community, the authorities with care of the community, are the principle of or cause of change and of remaining the same, an intrinsic and per se cause, not an extrinsic or accidental cause, of the unity and action of the community. We've done two main sections. We're on to the third and last main section of the talk, okay? Since Pius XI in 1929, in Divini Ilius Magistri on Christian Education, it has become common in Catholic circles to speak of three necessary societies. That is, societies so natural and basic that whatever other variation we may find among human cultures, all cultures need to find these three in some form or other. They are the family, the state, and the church. Compared to the other two, of course, the church is not merely a natural society, but a supernatural society dependent on God's grace, but answering a natural need for fallen human beings. The other two necessary societies one could consider as at the extreme scales of human association, the family as the smallest and most natural unit of political organization, and the state as the largest and most extensive and most encompassing unit of political organization. Pius calls the state the most perfect, in the sense of the most complete, in the natural as opposed to the supernatural order. The great Catholic political theorist Heinrich Rahman calls the state a unity of order, and while he clarifies that it is not natural in the sense of a biological organism, nobody would make that mistake, but it's a clarification that was important for him to make in light of Nazi racialist definitions of political nations. It also does not exist only in and through law. According to Rahman, the state precedes human law and lives in the ethical order as well as in the legal. It is a sociological form that exists in the informal consensus and in the spirit of civil friendship of the citizens, as well as in positive law. The state is a unity of order, and the common good is the good and end of this order. In other words, in his account, there is a state that then is perfected by law, but the law doesn't create the state. As the church is a real but mystical body, Rahman finds that the state can be conceived as a corpus politicum mysticum, which he says can best be translated as a moral organism, indicating that the character of the bond as well as the end of the corpus or body is not physical but moral. That is, it includes ethical virtues such as civic friendship, obedience, and mutual help in numerous freely formed associations and legal virtues such as the spirit of solidarity, mutual responsibility, and duty or obligation. it is clear that Raman is not using organism here as merely a metaphor, but as a proper analogy. The organic view, he says, sees the state as a whole, as a functional structure of many associations serving the varied human goals that develop with the progress of civilization, of the civitas humana. The term organism denotes a universitas, a whole, having a telos and an end in itself and being able to fulfill the telos by its own organization, organ, organization, organic. It is this character that makes the state, like the church, a perfect society. It is common to say that moral agents, including social bodies or moral organisms, have rights. But it would be better to say that they have given functions, vocations, or gifts. The relevant Latin term would be munera. These are precisely to be understood in terms of the inherent relation of formal and final cause. The purpose of the social body is what determines its form or nature, and the form or nature is what enables it to fulfill its purpose. Obviously, saying that family and state are necessary is not meant to ignore other levels of association or community, other moral organisms that make up society in the broad sociological sense. Between the smallest scale of the family and the most comprehensive scale of the state, there are gifts or vocations, social functions, that need to be carried out in complex systems. Modern political thinkers have all kinds of words to describe this ecology of multi-scaled social organization. We call it civil society. We talk about mediating institutions and free associations. And of course, we have in mind things like schools and guilds and charitable organizations and business ventures and neighborhood associations and Thomistic institutes and other such things. These all imply the need for different sorts of social entities, each with a form or nature and a telos or munus, a gift. And these social entities are more or less natural according as they more or less sustain themselves, the more or less they are integrated into a healthy network of other social associations, and the more or less their agency or principles of action are ordered to the individual and common goods of human beings, including not only those who are their members, but those who are the recipients of their action. Thus, a school is good to the extent that it sustainably assists families in educating children for responsible membership in the three necessary societies. A mafia enterprise, even if it has some goodness by being rooted in families and serving the protection of a neighborhood, lacks goodness to the extent that it is criminal and parasitic on rather than helping to strengthen civil society. Catholic social teaching is developed in part to make judgments about the goodness or naturalness of social activity. I will focus here on two key concepts. The first is the common good, which is not an aggregation or sum of individual goods, but a good of a whole community as that kind of community, the telos or fulfillment of the function of a social body. Charles de Coninck, in his famous essay on the primacy of the common good, leans heavily on the Aristotelian principle that the whole is greater than the part. Drawing specifically on Aquinas' discussion of angels in question 60 of the first part of the Summa, he argues that individual creatures by natural inclination are ordered to God, and so the good shared in common is superior to the individual good. This becomes the basis for de Coninck's handling of an objection that the social whole can't have primacy over its individual members because it is an accidental and not a substantial whole. So here he formulates the objection. It is said that the good of an accidental whole is less than the good of a substantial whole, but society is an incidental being and exists only by accident, therefore the common good ought to be subordinate to the good of the person. De Coninck offers this reply to the objection. This difficulty presupposes a false notion of the common good. In fact, the common good does not concern society formally insofar as it is an accidental whole. It is the good of the substantial wholes who are members of society, but it is the good of these substantial wholes only insofar as they are members of society. And if we consider the intrinsic common good of society as an accidental form, it would in no wise follow that it is inferior to that which is substantial. The upshot is that even if we grant that society is an accidental whole and not a substantial whole, which isn't very controversial and If we argued with that, we'd have all kinds of problems making sense to biologists. That does not mean that it is not natural, nor that it's good, that its good is inferior to the ends of its substantial parts. The common good is superior to the individual good precisely because the individuals that make up society have a social nature that can only be fulfilled in society. Imagining the individual good as separable from the common good would be artificial. It is natural for the individual to be fulfilled in society, so the community whose good helps fulfill the individual is itself natural in a way that even has primacy to the naturalness of the individual, insofar as the individual's substantial naturalness is inadequate to fulfill its moral, social, or political nature. Now, at this point, I can anticipate objections that the primacy of the common good sounds like a license for tyranny. This brings me to another key principle of Catholic social teaching, whose articulation is usually traced to Pope Leo XIII. In 1888, in an encyclical on liberty, Leo criticized liberal individualism as conceiving of liberty apart from social order. To refuse any bond of union between man and civil society on the one hand, he says, and God, the creator, and consequently the supreme lawgiver on the other, is plainly repugnant to nature, not only to the nature, not only of man, but of all created things. For of necessity, all effects must in some way be connected with their cause, and it belongs to the perfection of every nature to contain within itself that sphere and grade which the order of nature has assigned to it, namely that the lower should be subject and obedient to the higher. So individuals are only perfected through obedience to a higher power. Perhaps this sharpens the sense that the notion of a common good is potentially totalitarian. But Leo's presumption is that there is a natural and not an arbitrary social order. So the primacy of the common good is not a license for the higher order to exploit or abuse the lower. Indeed, it requires that the higher order must defer to and respect the dignity and integrity of its parts. Consider this key passage written 3 years later in 1891 from what has come to be considered the founding document of Catholic social teaching, and see how much it presumes that we can judge there to be forms of society that are more or less natural. This is Rerum Novarum, paragraph 13. A family, no less than a state, is, we have said, a true society, governed by an authority peculiar to itself, that is to say, by the authority of the father. Provided, therefore, the limits which are prescribed by the very purposes for which it exists be not transgressed, the family has at least equal rights with the state in the choice and pursuit of the things needful to its preservation and its liberty, its just liberty. In fact, the family must necessarily have rights and duties which are prior to those of the community and founded more immediately in nature. So appeal to the common good is not a blank check for state power. It is in fact a requirement that state power serve the authentic natural goods of society, including respecting the proper or natural functions or gifts of other levels of social association. This is the insight that will come to be called, in later writing, the principle of subsidiarity. And here's a passage. This is paragraph 14 of Rerum Novarum. If a family finds itself in exceeding distress, utterly deprived of the counsels of friends, and without any prospect of extricating itself, it is right that extreme necessity be met by public aid, since each family is a part of the commonwealth. In like manner, if within the precincts of the household there occur grave disturbance of mutual rights, public authority should intervene to force each party to yield to the other its proper due. For this is not to deprive citizens of their rights, but justly and properly to safeguard and strengthen them. But, he continues, the rulers of the commonwealth must go no further. Here, nature bids them stop. Paternal authority can be neither abolished nor absorbed by the state, for it has the same source as human life itself. Even the fact that the principle of subsidiarity has only been recently articulated, by that name, it's actually less than 100 years old, I think, confirms that it depends on a conception of social associations as natural and on the ability to judge whether particular social associations are more or less natural. It is an Aristotelian principle that never needed to be articulated so long as social organization, by a kind of necessity, observed a natural kind of scale, hierarchy, and order. It is only thanks to the new things in the social realm, which make possible less natural forms of social organization, depriving social forms of their functions or gifts, that the principle has to be made explicit and invoked and defended in order to restore a proper ordering of society to the common good. As Leo was aware, civil society as a whole only makes sense as a network of lesser but not independent real societies, all of which together spring from the natural impulse of man's social nature to support and help each other. He quotes Proverbs 18:19, "A brother that is helped by his brother is like a strong city." It's just a few pages of conclusion now. If I had more time, I might explore the question of how much a vision of political society developed for the ancient Greek polis can be projected onto the scale of the modern nation state. Instead, I will note that whatever the differences between the two scales of political organization, they are at least both genuinely political. Indeed, it is hard to conceive of the management of the nation state without thinking of actual people gathered to discuss and deliberate in particular cities. Indeed, cities are still the synecdoches for national and even transnational bodies, Washington, D.C., Moscow, Brussels. And even the ancient world had its leagues and empires, of course, always named after the city in which it was based, the Athenian or the Roman. It is not as much talked about today, but this is why many 20th century Thomists were even willing to advocate for some form of world government, truly encompassing the common good of all humanity. Their assumption was that such government, even on a global scale, would still be genuinely humane, carried out in a particular place by rational individuals. I hate to say it, but we can no longer take for granted that political organization will always be based in human deliberation, geographically located in cities. In some accounts of the future of artificial intelligence algorithms, there is a technocratic nightmare of social control that would make Alistair MacIntyre and other modern Aristotelians yearn for the humanity, the concrete locality, the naturalness of the nation state. Political nightmares, whether Huxley's Brave New World or Orwell's 1984, or the transhumanist visions of modern tech bros, are nightmares precisely because they are unnatural. We need to be able to say that and to think that. And those advancing unnatural forms of political organization need us not to be able to say and think that. They need to prevent us making judgments of what is natural and hide from us the concept of the politically natural. So what can we do? It is some sign of hope that we have a new Pope Leo who is attentive to the 21st century's new things. The church and the world need a spiritual leader who can help us articulate the ways of life we are designed for, the social organization that is most natural and necessary for us as the rational political animal. As always, with the development of Catholic social teaching, this is an application of the gospel, but it is also, and even more fundamentally, an application of philosophy of Aristotelian natural reason. And Plato too saw that philosophy in this sense has a political function. Philosophy is care of the soul, it is a political art, it is the craftsmanship of freedom, because political life is about care of the soul. So consider with this in mind that very strange image from Aristotle of the doctor doctoring himself. As a characterization of nature, this is indeed an awkward and imperfect comparison, as Professor Frey and Aquinas both agree. But if the philosopher is a doctor of the soul, then the doctor doctoring himself is also an image of political deliberation, the political body seeking to order its activity to the common good. In that sense, the doctor doctoring himself is political, but also consummately natural, a rational body moving itself by its own intrinsic rational principles. It is also an image then of the philosopher reflecting on what we as rational agents need to know. This is why I have tried here to frame Catholic social teaching as an extension of the Aristotelian insight about why the rational being is the social being, a continuing, developing reflection about how to talk about and contribute to virtuous common life under cultural conditions that make it increasingly difficult for us to experience discern, and share a true and natural conception of the common good. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.